This next case is SK Pegtall Engineers, excuse me if I mispronounced that, versus Mid Valley Real Estate Solutions. May I have the interim appearances, please?
Good morning. John Riley on behalf of SK Pegtall Engineers.
Mr. Riley, go ahead and introduce yourselves if you would, please.
Good morning. Andrew Ford on behalf of Hepworth College View of Texas.
All right.
Good morning. Daniel Woodward on behalf of Hepworth College View.
Thank you. Mr. Riley, are you going to be doing all the arguments this morning?
I am.
All right, thanks. And how about for Mid Valley Council?
Good morning, Your Honor. Dean Newworth and David Lenio appearing for the respondent, Mid Valley.
And Mr. Newworth, you'll be doing all of the argument.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, thank you. Welcome. This case is set for 1 hour. That means, that each side has a half an hour. Mr. Riley, you need to keep track of your own time, and if you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal, you can just stop and save yourself a little time. The numbers are pretty clear on the podium.
We'll probably stop and then just reserve the time.
That's fine. You get a half an hour however you choose to spend it, so it's kind of up to you, sir. Thank you. And whenever you're ready, go ahead, please, Mr. Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. I've represented design professionals for about 15 years, and that mostly means architects and engineers. When I represent design professionals, I do generally two things for them. I either help them with their contracts on the front side of a project, or help them with litigation should it go on the back side of a project. And when I help my design professional clients, when they do get into litigation, I often find myself talking to them about the claims that have been brought against them. And in construction projects or business transaction projects, commercial litigation projects, that's pretty easy to talk about how the fact is that you can only sue the parties in those projects that you have a contract with. Sue through the contracts, there is no negligence claim, there's no independent duty. The harder question I have answered for my clients is when there is a house involved. That's a lot more complicated. And I think that's why I'm here today to talk to you about that, is because that's the boundary that we're in right now. I'm here to ask you to find that when it is only commercial parties, it is only commercial entities, it is only construction that's involved, that the economic loss rule applies. And the two playing fields have been established by this court and also through the U.S. Supreme Court, as you all know. On one hand, the Greenberg, Town of Alma case, BRW. One playing field is construction/commercial projects. The other playing field that we're here to talk about is residential, and that is the Cosmopolitan AC excavating cases. And we're right in the middle of those, the boundary, because in this case, we're only dealing with commercial entities arising out of a construction project.
Yet the sole focus is a home that somebody's going to end up occupying, right? With short limitations for trying to rectify conditions. And
correct. And we haven't reached that situation in this particular case yet. And that's where I think this case should end up, which is drawing that line. Once the house is sold, and I argue this in my brief, that's when it flips into the residential independent duty situation. It's been expressed in Cosmopolitan, was expressed in AC excavating. And the reason why it goes back to Cosmopolitan, which it talks about the policy reasons for that independent duty is the absence of bargaining power that homeowner has. And also, it talks about going to the independent duty when you go back and look either the Whitlock DU case, which was a trampoline case, personal injury, or else the Lannan Taco Bell case, which was a robbery/shooting, personal injury. That's when the courts have found an independent duty arises. In this situation, purely in a commercial transaction which arises out of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in East River, which uses that language, and I'm sure they meant it, because it's about a steamship, which is they don't want contracts to drown in a sea of torts. They want to maintain that distinction, make contracts valid, so that people enter into their contracts, and the people know what their expectancy interest and what the risks and rewards are by entering into those contracts. And that's really the policy reasons. The independent duty, when there is some person who doesn't have the ability to bargain, again, for a house, someone who may be the biggest investment in their life, they don't have the ability or the sophistication even, perhaps, to bargain. And then on the other side of the coin is the economic loss rule, where we want contracts to apply and have some meaning. In this case, we only have commercial parties. We have Alpine Bank, which was originally a plaintiff, and we have Mid Valley, which was more or less their subsidiary, and I'm sure we'll get into some of the questions about what that Mid Valley entity is and composed of. But they certainly don't need any protection here. And the contract that's at the center of all this is a construction loan agreement that Alpine Bank had with Sun Mountain. And then just like you would expect in a typical situation where parties bring a case on the commercial side, Alpine Bank sued Sun Mountain. Sun Mountain then sued HP, who was a soils engineer. And then Alpine Bank also sued Shannon Custom Homes, Shannon Meckley, who was the builder, and Shannon Custom Homes sued my client, SK Padel. So that's how you would expect the typical remedies to work. And so the remedies were available to everyone in this case, and they were used. What's happened here and why we've ended up here is this end-around economic loss rule, where they're trying to, instead of suing through the contracts, Mid-Valley is now asking our clients, or claiming our clients, have some type of independent duty because it's a house and that they're a homeowner. And that's where we think the distinction needs to be drawn, going back to Cosmopolitan Homes, going back to agency excavating, because you're looking at the house and the homeowner in a different situation because those people intend to live there. They're not involved in a commercial transaction. They're involved in a residential transaction.
Yeah, but lending institutions, aren't they more on the homeowner's side, you know, because they're helping the homeowner get in the house, right?
They are more on the homeowner's side, but they're still in business, and they're part of the, quote, interrelated contracts that are talked about in DRW in terms of having the construction loan agreement. And again, I'm not going to be able to reference all these specifics because it is a large document that's a little bit hard to read, but they talk about all these abilities that the bank had in terms of monitoring the construction and being involved in the construction process, approving the subcontractors, approving the builders.
Counsel, can I just follow up where you left off? Just to get your response to the Court of Appeals concern, and I'll just read it, allowing defendants to avoid liability merely because Mid-Valley is not a traditional homeowner would afford defendants a windfall resulting solely from the fortuity that the latent defect caused damage before Mid-Valley could sell the house. Could I get you to respond to that?
Sure, and I think the concern goes back to what I tried to express earlier, which is once the house gets out of the commercial transaction, once it's out of the construction, once it's out of the construction loan agreement, once it goes into the market, they want to make sure, according to what I was hearing from the Court of Appeals, both at the oral argument and at the opinion, is that they're afraid that some entity down the road that owns a house is a corporation or a trust or some other sophisticated party, and how are we supposed to parse that out? And you'll see again in my brief that I think the line should be drawn once the house is out of that commercial side of the business. And the other way to look at this is if Mid-Valley or the bank had brought the suit, I would still be here arguing the same thing that Sun Mountain, who's the developer, could bring a claim against my client, because my client didn't have a contract with the developer. My client had the contract with the builder. Goes back to East River, sues through the contracts, make the contracts have meaning.
So I guess you're saying there is no windfall.
I don't think there's a windfall. There's no windfall, as long as that's where the line's drawn. I understand if you allow some kind of claim that if it's an owner who has a property once they're living in it, that it's a corporation or they're renting it to make money, or that they're a trust that has title to it, you know, once it's been sold on the open market, I understand that that's a windfall argument. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals was concerned about.
And that didn't happen here?
That did not happen here. This house was never sold. I cannot remember exactly when it was completed. I want to say pretty much when the economy went south in 08. It sat vacant for some amount of time. And then these problems happened in 2010, which is when Alpine Bank did the deed in lieu of foreclosure. So basically Sun Mountain Homes turned the house back over because they weren't able to pay the construction loan. And then Mid-Valley became the title holders as a result of that deed in lieu of foreclosure. So you've got all these contracts that tie back into each other, and I think that's what BRW talks about, is the interrelated contracts in these construction and commercial situations.
Still trying to sort this out, though. Mid-Valley is way down the line, right?
They are further down the line. That's
They're
correct.
Not the construction lender.
They are basically a subsidiary of the construction lender. They're a single asset entity. Their only purpose is to basically sell this house, and they only got the house as a result of the deed in lieu of foreclosure.
What do we do with that information? I know that may be the second issue, but...
I think that is part of the second issue, and I'll start addressing that right now, which is I think that, frankly, is the harder part of the case. And my response to that, one is in my brief, and I can't remember if I said this in my brief or not on the other, but one talks about a recent Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decision, the Bramski case that came out this last summer. It is a gun case. But basically, the Supreme Court said, you know, look at the reality of the situation. And the fancy word they used that I had to look up was artifice, you know, which means don't more or less hide the ball. Let's look at what the real end user of it is. And in our position, we think the real end user is Alpine Bank, because they created Mid-Valley single asset company. And as we probably all know, although this is my opinion, that, you know, if the house is ever sold or there's a result in the lawsuit, say we lose, or certainly the defendants who've already settled, we know where the money's going. It's not going to Mid-Valley.
Counsel, can I take you a step back and have you explain a little bit more about the line you would have us draw at the sale of the house, so it's taken out of this commercial context and sold. Under your view, does it matter to whom it is sold? You seem to be contemplating both like an individual residential homeowner, but also another developer or a trust or some other corporate type of entity that might be the end purchaser.
I think the only way to really understand the economic loss and create the boundary is once it's sold, it doesn't matter who buys it. I know there's probably people out there who do the same work I do who don't agree with me, but I think that's the only way to reconcile BRW, Greenberg, and Town of Alma with Cosmopolitan and AC Excavating is drawing the line right there where it ends the commercial construction interrelated contracts. Go back to the independent duty there and frankly ignore who owns the house, and in the sense that it's been sold on the open market, they intend to live there. It goes back, in my mind, kind of to a reasonable person standard, if you will, which we all learn in law school, and provide some kind of direction for people in the construction industry in terms of who they need to worry about and making sure that the contracts that they do enter, and I think we all want them enter into, have some meaning.
Thank you.
I can't remember, Justice Hobbs, if you asked this or Justice Ide, but the other point about the after-created entities, I think it was you, Justice Hobbs, that I wanted to bring up, was that the other reason why the after-created entities is a little bit meaningless in the sense of applying to economic law school is because I think in any business transaction, the parties could escape the economic law school by simply creating an entity after they've entered into a contract, and then claiming that entity now holds title to the contract or the whatever the business relationship is, that the economic loss rule doesn't apply to them because they didn't exist at the time. And I think that would be a concern if we're worried about after created entities and drawing a line at that time that someone down the road isn't subject to that.
I don't know. These corporate entities do have a separate life, legal life.
Correct.
In the Delphi case, hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's been a while since we
wrote it.
I know. But, these things fly out of your head until attorneys put them back in.
Right.
But that was all interrelated, contractual, upfront. Everybody had the right to be at the table, negotiate, work out the whole relationship. General contractors, subcontractors, et cetera, right?
And that's exactly what we're arguing here, because Alpine Bank was at the table when all these contracts got worked out.
Yeah, but Med Valley wasn't.
And as I said before, they're basically a subsidiary.
So we need to pierce the corporate veil, or there's some other kind of...
The arguments that were put in were alter ego, which I will acknowledge that Mr. Neuwirth indicated that wasn't raised until a motion for reconsideration on summary judgment. So I know there's an issue with that. But the facts will show, and it's part of the record, Anthony Thompson, who goes by Tony Thompson, testified in his deposition that he's basically controls Mid Valley. He's the person at the bank who controls Mid Valley as part of this construction loan. So the institutional knowledge that was in Alpine Bank is pretty much imparted in Mid Valley. So the whole interrelated contract would still apply because Alpine Bank was part of the construction loan when all the development for the project took place.
But I just wanted to make sure I understand. It would be your position, however, that if Sun Mountain had sold the building to Joe Blow, Joe Blow would have a cause of action?
Correct.
Okay. Because there's obviously no contractual relationship, no contractual way of resolving this dispute, so TOR is really the only avenue available to Joe Blow.
Correct.
In this hypothetical. But there is a contractual way, you say, of resolving this dispute. Because Mid Valley and Alpine are essentially standing in the same shoes.
Correct. And they can go back to Sun Mountain, which they did. Sun Mountain go back to HP, which they did. And then Alpine / Mid Valley go to the builder, Shannon Custom Homes, which they did. And Shannon Custom Homes brings a claim against my client, which they did.
Sure.
And that's the remedy that's available here.
I appreciate you saying that you think that the second question is dispositive. That's the way you're looking at the second suit question is really dispositive of this case.
I think that's a harder question. The second question about the after created entity, if that's what you're asking me, is a harder question.
I am asking you that, and what I wanted to make certain about is that we reframe that question, we the Supreme Court reframe that question. Do you think that in our reframing of the question, we captured the essence of your argument here?
You did. And part of reframing it is we probably don't have legal argument at the trial court level on that alter ego. I think we have evidence of it because of what was testified by Mr. Thompson and what's in his deposition, which is part of the record here. But I acknowledge there may need to be a finding of that at the trial court level.
Okay. Thank you.
Again, the situation here isn't a situation where a bank needs protection. It's a commercial entity. They're able to take care of themselves. It's about reasonable results in terms of interpreting what a homeowner means. And in our position, what's happened is everyone says if you own the home, whether it would have been Alpine Bank or Mid Valley or even Sun Mountain, no, those aren't homeowners. They're part of the interrelated contracts because it's still a commercial transaction. I want to talk a little bit about Mid Valley's arguments. And in their briefs, again, they focus on the project that it's a residence. That they look at the AC excavating case, look at the Cosmopolitan case, and my response to that is they, again, simply ignore the commercial transaction element in this case, which is all the people who are involved in the construction are still part of the case, the house has never been sold in, as Justice Ray said, Joe Blow or someone else to live into it. The other point that Mid Valley brings up is they're focusing on that word homeowner. Same concept. So residents and homeowner, and I think you probably understand what my position is. We're not in that situation. I'm asking for the court to draw that boundary line because we've got the two playing fields between the BRW case line, Greenberg, Town of Alma case line, and another playing field with residential houses, Cosmopolitan and AC excavating, where the court has found that there's policy reasons for protection of these homeowners. I don't think there's any policy reason in this case that a bank needs to be protected.
Mr. Ryder, let me talk to you a little bit about whether Mid Valley has exactly the same contractual rights and remedies under the original contracts as Alpine. Can you talk to me about that, please?
I have to admit that's a little bit murky because it looks like in the deed of lieu of foreclosure that construction loan agreement was transferred to Mid Valley. I may be saying that wrong just because the deed in lieu of foreclosure and the construction loan agreement themselves are so technical and hard to read. And I have to admit that I had to get a real estate person in my office to help me understand what those contracts mean. But to me, that shows that this is a commercial transaction.
Sure.
You've got the contract.
Sure. Let me ask you then this question. Do you think that this economic loss rule, our decision on that, is really going to depend upon what we make of that? Of that relationship between Alpine and Mid Valley, a murky one at best, as you put it?
Well,
go ahead.
Here's what I'm thinking. I think from the place where we are today, that this court has the opportunity to establish that boundary line for the two playing fields between construction slash commercial cases and then residential. The boundary line is once the house is sold.
Sold to a non-commercial owner? What would the holding be?
I think if it's even a commercial owner, I know there's people out there who disagree with me because they think it should still apply, but I think there's probably some policy reasons, as expressed by Justice Iden by the Court of Appeals, that becomes a lot harder decision to make, because then you have to take into other factors. You know, what's the sophistication of the entity? Did they have lawyers involved in it? Was it a custom home? Was it a residential tract home? And I don't know if the court wants to have trial courts figuring that out. Certainly you can create a test if you wanted to, but I'm advocating to you today that I think a simple way to do it would be to say once it's sold on the open market, then the economic loss rule no longer applies and it's the independent duty.
And you think, of course, that what happened here was not a sale.
Correct.
And the reason it's not a sale is why?
None of the contracts were extinguished. They all still applied. The construction loan agreement still applied. The parties ended up suing each other through some of it was negligence claims, some of it was breach of contract claims.
And also, is it your position that it's not a sale because all of the contractual remedies, I'm coming back around again, but all of the contractual remedies as against Sun Mountain, the others at Alpine Head, Mid Valley.
Correct.
So it's more in the nature of an assignment than a sale?
And that's exactly one of the arguments that we talk about. You know, is there a third-party beneficiary of the construction loan agreement or the alter ego is an assignment? I think all those are briefed by all these parties.
So you don't think an evidentiary remand on the point of who Mid Valley is necessary? Because we can go back through the commercial loop here and the way that people allege their damages, let's say, under contract.
Correct. I think there's enough evidence on the record. I will admit that wasn't briefed at the trial court.
Yeah.
We come to my conclusion right now on my moments. I probably will reserve a little bit of time here at the end.
Thank you.
I would ask you to enforce the economic loss rule in this commercial business transaction. Parties who enter into contracts need to be able to rely on those contracts. That's been expressed in BRW. It's been expressed in East River. It's been expressed in Town of Alma and in Greenberg. And as we've talked about a lot, I'd ask you to establish that boundary line. Once it gets out of the commercial relationship, then if the court wants to maintain this independent duty, which I'm not advocating we should change it. In fact, I'm not advocating any change in the law. I'm only advocating that we establish a boundary. That's all I have. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. You do have 6.5 minutes if you choose to respond.
Thank you.
Mr. Mueller?
Good morning, may it please the court. Dean Newarth and Dave Lenya representing Mid Valley. I couldn't disagree more with everything that I heard Mr. Riley say, with all due respect, from top to bottom. Before I get to some of those particulars, there is a very important piece that was missing from his presentation, which is the statute that expresses a very important legislative policy about this duty, and that's the Construction Defect Action Reform Act, which is found at 1320.801 and following. And that's a statute that was first enacted in 2001, the year after Town of Alma. It's been amended in 03, 07, and 2010 at least. Here's what it says. 1320.802.5 sub 4 defines construction professionals to include engineers. Both defendants in this case are engineers. 1320.804 and 802.51 expressly allow a negligence claim to be brought against a construction professional where real property, not just residential, but real property has been damaged by a defect in design by a construction professional's improvement to that real property. Then there's another provision in the statute, 1320.802.53, says a claimant for such a claim is any person who asserts a claim other than a prosecutor. And the reason it accepts prosecutors is that this statute is a civil statute, has no criminal provisions. Now, the statute does not define person, but there is a provision in the Colorado Revised Statutes which defines person for the entire Colorado Revised Statutes, that's section 24401 sub 8. It expressly defines a person to include not just a natural person, but also any corporation, any LLC, any trust. It considers corporate entities, commercial entities, to be people for the purposes of bringing claims. So what we have is Sodera expressing a clear legislative policy that anybody who owns any real property has a cause of action in negligence against construction professionals, which include these defendants, for their negligent work. And we discussed this statute in our answer brief, and it was not addressed at all in the reply briefs. And I submit to you but that statute alone is dispositive of this duty question. I do not see how you can draw the line that Mr. Riley is asking you to draw without directly contravening.
So would Alpine have that cause of action under the statute?
Alpine would have that cause of action.
Why?
Under the statute. If it owned the house, it doesn't. The house was transferred from Sun Mountain to Mid Valley as part of the deed in lieu, which was held in lieu of a foreclosure sale.
So it's an effective sale?
Yes.
It's a transfer of title to Mid Valley?
Yes.
That Alpine didn't have?
I'm sorry, Justice Hobbs, I'm not quite following your question.
Well, I just want you to explain the facts now. Why? You said Alpine and Mid Valley would both have the cause of action or not under the statute. I'm just trying to figure that out.
Okay, sorry. What I'm trying to say is under the statute, anybody has that cause of action, whether it's a bank, a real estate marketing entity, a natural person, whoever. I wasn't talking specifically about the relationship between.
Do they have to own the house, though, under that statute?
The claimant has to be somebody with standing, which I presume would be somebody who owns the house. And.
Well, what, is that consistent with the sale of the house theory that we just heard?
A claimant, I'm reading the statute, 1328.02.53, means a person, other than the attorney general or district attorneys, who asserts a claim against a construction professional that alleges a defect in the construction of an improvement to real property. And then you have to read the statutes together. 1328.04 says that a negligence claim can be brought if there's been actual damage.
By whom?
By anybody who's a claimant.
So
a claimant can be any person, including a commercial entity.
Sure. The way you're reading that statute makes it seem like it completely overruled town of Alma, all of that line of case.
I don't know that it overruled
it. And if you say it didn't, why not?
I don't know that it overruled it. I think what it did was it recognized that there is an independent tort duty when you're talking about construction work on real property. And I think it extended that tort duty in certain instances only when there's actual damage, not when there's, say, a technical violation of a building code.
Right.
But when there's actual damage, it extended that tort duty to any kind of property, including commercial property, because there's no limitation as to the kind of property. And in fact, there are a number of provisions in SEDARA where the legislature distinguishes between commercial property and residential property for certain purposes, such as the length of time to provide a notice provision. It defines commercial property, by the way, as property that is zoned, which I think is a much cleaner way of making the distinction.
Now, just to be clear, the tort damages we're talking about are, in effect, what it would take to cure the defect, right? Rectify the defect.
Well, we have actual damage to real property here. This is not a situation like Reinberg, where we're talking about unsatisfactory returns on investment.
Okay, so tell me what it is. What's the damages here? Have they been determined yet, etc.?
Yes, they have. So the damages are that there are these enormous cracks throughout the foundation and the walls of the building itself. And the theory of liability is that the damage came about because the soils here, they were not expansive, which is what we normally have in Colorado. They were actually compressive, so that if they got wet, they settled. And the engineers here knew that. They did a study, and they realized that the soils were compressive, and this is in the record that we've got. We've only got a partial record, because we're up here on an interlocutory appeal after denial of summary judgment, which is not normally appealable, but we do have the soils report. They took a risk. They said, even if the soils become wet and settle, a spread foot foundation will take care of the problem. Well, it didn't take care of the problem. At some point, there was settlement, and these enormous cracks appeared, and the damage has been estimated as $1.3 million, which was basically the value of the house at the time of the foreclosure sale. So there is a windfall here, justified, because we haven't received the penny. And the problem with the case right now is the reason the trial judge certified it, if you look at Appendix 5 in your record, which is her order certifying the interlock up to the Court of Appeals, she says, if I'm wrong about the economic loss rule not applying here, then this case is done. So if you accept their position, we don't get anything from them. They're totally excused from $1.3 million.
Don't you just not get anything in negligence? I mean, you still have your contract remedies. Although I guess you only filed your case in negligence.
We only filed a case in negligence.
So that's why the case would be done.
That's why the case would be done.
So, but did you, what efforts did you make to pursue your contract remedies?
So there was a complaint, and the complaint had four claims in it, and Alpine Bank pursued its breach of contract remedies that it had against Sun Mountain, so forth, and Mid Valley pursued the remedies it had, which under the law are only in negligence because Mid Valley had no contract with anybody. And if I can talk a little bit about...
Well, isn't that kind of assuming? I mean, the answer, you say they pursued, Mid Valley presumed their remedies, which are only in negligence. I mean, isn't that the essence of the question that we're trying to ask today?
That is why we're here.
So, I mean, I understand that that's maybe why whoever was lawyering the case at that time made that decision, but that is the essence of what we're trying to decide. So let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Ryland, which is simply this: what isn't what happened between Alpine and Mid Valley more in the nature of an assignment than a sale?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Nothing was assigned. I disagree with Mr. Riley's reading of the documents. You can look at the deed in lieu yourself and the construction loan agreement.
But I am.
The only...
And walk me through that.
Okay, so the way the deal was structured is that Alpine Bank has a standard construction loan with the developer Sun Mountain, and it's one of those foreign contracts. And it's just a loan agreement. It's not a construction agreement. So
then why do they call it a deed? Well, go ahead. I want to know. Just walk me through the documents.
So there's a construction loan agreement, and the loan is secured by a deed of trust on the property while the property is under construction. So the loan is extended. The money is used to build the house. The house is completed. The loan is extended in 2007. The house is completed November 2008. It goes on the market. Market tanks because of the recession. It sits there for 2.5 years. And then in the meantime, the developer is still paying off the loan. The developer runs out of money and defaults on the loan. So now Alpine is in a situation where it can implement its security interest in the deed of trust and foreclose on the house. There could be a foreclosure sale under the statutory scheme. But what commonly happens in these situations, and what happened here, is that rather than go through a foreclosure sale, the parties agree to a deed in lieu of a foreclosure sale. As part of that transaction, Alpine creates Mid Valley, which is a wholly owned subsidiary. It's solely a marketing entity. And this is a routine practice. You may always hear that banks do not like to be in the real estate business. Banks do banking and lending. So this is a routine procedure in which banks engage. Sets up Mid Valley as a marketing entity as part of the deed in lieu agreement between Alpine and the developer. The developer deeds the house directly to Mid Valley. So that's the only quote unquote assignment. It's not really an assignment of anything. There's no assignment of a claim, there's no assignment of the contract itself. All that happens is Mid Valley receives title to the house so that Mid Valley can sell the house, because that's why Mid Valley exists.
So it's not a deed of trust situation. At this time, it's outright conveyance of the property.
Yes, right.
So for the purposes of the statute, then Mid Valley stands as a claimant who's got a defective house.
Yes. Going back to your original question, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. As between Alpine and Mid Valley, it's Mid Valley that is the claimant. It's not Alpine that's the claimant, because Mid Valley is the one that has the house.
Right.
Okay.
Counselor.
So that may meet the threshold test here that was suggested to us. Who's the owner of the house? Right? I mean, wasn't that the bright line that was suggested here?
Well, I thought the bright line that was suggested, are you saying, by Mr. Riley?
Yeah.
That bright line was that it's not until... That, yes, that could be the bright line, yes.
I'm just trying to follow the logic of the thought.
That's one place that you could draw if you were to accept that argument.
Well, and I guess just to follow up on that, I mean, I assume his argument is it has to be sold to a third party, for lack of a better term, someone who is not involved in that initial commercial arrangement. And I guess that's the part I want you to address. How is Mid Valley just a stranger here?
Well, because the law recognizes it as a stranger. I mean, it was set up as a legitimate separate corporation. If you think about the Hobby Lobby case, and this is something that was mentioned in one of the amicus briefs in this case, you know, corporations are organizations through which people act, and there's a reason why the law allows entities and people to set up corporations. So it was set up legally, legitimately, before we had any notice of this problem. It wasn't as if it was set up in order to do an end run around a contract. I mean, it was set up the market.
Let me stop you there. I mean, I guess his argument is that that's precisely why an organization like that or a corporation like this would be set up to make an in-round around the contracts. Can you respond to that?
Well, number one, there's absolutely no evidence of that here, okay? But that's not, in fact, all the evidence you have in this case is totally the opposite, that it was not set up to do any kind of in-run. And let me try and answer your question, Justice Ide, by getting to a point that hasn't been brought out yet that I think is very important, which is how do we determine what kind of contracts are interrelated? Okay, so the way that you reframe the second cert question, you referenced the BRW case. If you go back to that case, what happened is the interrelated contracts in that case are all construction contracts among construction professionals. So the city has a contract with an engineer. The engineer prepares the plans and specs. Those plans and specs then go into the city's contract with the general. And by stipulation, the same plans and specs are incorporated specifically in every subcontractor contract right down the line. And the rationale of BRW was that if subcontractor down here wants to sue an engineer over here, he goes through this chain because that specific duty, that construction performance duty, has been incorporated all the way down the line, okay? What do we have here? There's a key difference. The difference is Alpine's agreement is a loan agreement. It is not a construction agreement. The construction performance duties that were in these defendants' contracts with the developer and the general contractor are not incorporated in a loan agreement between the bank and the developer. And you wouldn't expect them to be incorporated because the bank was not doing construction work. It was lending money. The risks that it was allocating were for a loan, not for risk of a construction defect. So it's completely comparing apples and oranges to say that construction loans and duties in construction loans for lending are interrelated with construction contracts and duties in those contracts. And there's another reason why the issue fails, which is in the argument fails. In the BRW case, going back to my little visual diagram, the engineer's over here and the subcontractor's down here. There was no prior independent duty in tort. And the Court of Appeals created one. And you guys said, hey, wait a minute, you don't just create a duty between construction professionals, right? But in our situation, we already have an independent duty that's been around for 30-some-odd years, and which has been embraced by the legislature in Sedara, not just in Sedara, but also in the statute of limitations. 1380-104, which was also amended at the time in 2001 that Sedara was implemented, so that you've got this scheme that's running together. That really, that's why I say I disagree on every level. Mid Valley is not an assignee. These contracts are not interrelated, and there is an independent duty in negligence that applies to any owner of any kind of property in the state of Colorado.
Could I ask a question? I was kind of intrigued, especially given the way you're presenting the argument. You talk about the Construction Defect Act in your brief a lot with sort of equivocal terms about it supports an independent duty. Words like that. Why isn't this, according to your theory, just simply purely a question of a statutory action? Does this fit the statute or does it not? And what does anything else in common law have to do with it?
That's a really good question, Justice Coates. I think it does fit the statute, and I think for whatever reason, it's kind of been overlooked in the jurisprudence up to this point, in that you have Cosmopolitan Homes, who said builders have this duty in tort, and by the way, there was a really important policy reason in Cosmopolitan Homes, which hasn't been talked about yet either, which is that the privity of contract claim, or the contract claim is limited by privity, but the tort claim kind of runs with the house and provides an incentive for builders to build homes in a sound fashion, and that's limited by the statute of limitations. But I'm digressing. So you have Cosmopolitan Homes, and then you have Tonnenbaum, and Alma looks at Cosmopolitan Homes and says, that's an independent tort duty, and it survives the economic loss rule. Okay, black and white, doesn't address the nature of the owner of a home. Then AC Excavating comes along, reaffirms Cosmopolitan, reaffirms Alma's declaration that the economic loss rule does not bar the independent tort duty, and also says, by the way, the tort duty applies to all the builders, all the construction professionals, not just the builders, and draws some of that from Sedara, okay? And But nobody else goes back and looks at Sadar, and once Sadar is in place in 2001 and as it's been amended since then, and says, how does it affect this prior common law duty? And so I think what I'm telling you is it subsumes that duty and goes beyond that duty.
And so I take it, even if at this point we decided, we were probably wrong in Cosmopolitan Homes, you'd be saying, well, it really wouldn't make any difference because either for their own reasons or as a result of what we said, the legislature has now codified what kind of an action you can bring against construction professionals, and that's what governs the area. Is that what you're saying, or would you be going that far?
Well, you know, as a lawyer, I hate to concede anything, but I think you're right that right now we have a statutory recognition of this duty, and we also have a separate kind of parallel common law evolution of the duty. I think that for 30 plus years now, people have been following the common law duty. But if you wanted to say we don't need that duty anymore because the duty's in the statute, that probably would make things clearer.
But you do seem to be saying, don't you, that we couldn't limit or further refine the duty that we had previously defined. We couldn't limit it in the way that's suggested by opposing counsel because now there's a statute that actually codifies that.
Yes, that, I agree with that completely.
Now that doesn't take care of the whole common law issue. We have to figure out how far the legislature went with displacing the common law, right? I mean, so we're going to have to construe the statute.
I think so. I mean, I think you do need to construe the statute. And the fact that both respondents, I mean, petitioners ignored it in their reply briefs tells me that maybe it's really crucial because we brought it up in our answer brief.
Well, counsel, I'm sorry, just can I follow up on this? What would be the statutory terms we would be construing? I mean, I guess you point out that the statute says person. and okay, so your client is a person, but can any person bring, I mean, there's got to be some limiting effect to just any person, right? And I guess you keep returning to owner. Do you have to be an owner under the statute?
Well, in terms of person, you know, that term is defined in the statute I cited before in Title 2, 24418, so there's a long list of who those persons are, and there's
I understand that. I mean, and let's just say you are a person, but lots of people, I'm a person too, under that definition. I guess I'm trying to figure out what, in addition to being a person, do you have to show to be able to sue?
Well, you have to satisfy whatever the statutory criteria are, but I would assume that you revert back to the traditional concepts of standing. You have to have suffered an injury, and in fact, the Sedera evinces a policy decision by the legislature that they don't want these lawsuits when there's no actual damage. So you have to have actual damage.
So any person which you qualify for who has damage?
Well, it has to be for an improvement to real property. Okay, I mean, there's more statutory provisions in here. It's not particularly complicated, but it's not as simple as I can tell you in the short amount of time that I have.
And if I could, sort of following up on this, and where I was kind of going with this is, would it follow then that the legislature has defined an action against a construction professional for negligence? And therefore, if you're provided an action under these circumstances by the statute, then you've got it. If you're not, then you don't have it. Suggesting, no, you could still have a negligence action even though you don't qualify for what the legislature has provided?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that if we don't have an action under the statute, then we don't under the common law, because the way I read the statute takes the common law duty, accepts it, and expands on it. Okay? If you disagree with me on that and you say New Earth is all web and the statute has nothing to do with any of this, then we're still left with this, with the common law duty. What do we do with it? So I
So you would, you wouldn't be willing to go with saying what the legislature has done here, whether as a result of our prior law that they intended to codify or expand on, whatever, but they have defined the duties of a construction professional with regard to negligence.
I mean, the way I read the statute, I think it's unambiguous. The way they've defined it is that a construction, if there's actual damage to real property, the construction professional has a duty in negligence to any owner of that property, be it a person or a natural person.
Well,
or
and
a
that
person
that's, in let me stop you there. I mean, is the
and whether
the
it's
owner,
commercial or residential.
Is that the what you have to be as an owner? You used the word owner.
Well,
or homeowner, you've used that.
Okay, you know, we haven't gotten that far in the briefing, and I'd be happy to provide supplemental briefs if you want, but I'll tell you there's a case that this court decided in 1969 called Kellogg v. Pizza Oven, which is favorably cited in the Greinberg decision, the companion case to Town of Alma in footnote 4 of Greinberg. And in that case, an architect was held to owe a duty in negligence to a commercial lessee. So maybe you don't have to be an owner. Maybe you can be a lessee. Maybe it's any inch, maybe any recognized interest in real property is sufficient. But I mean, we just haven't briefed that issue.
Yeah. But you picked your horse, right? You picked the negligence horse, right? Whatever this is.
We picked the negligence horse.
So you're
that's
not,
right.
You're
because
not.
We didn't have interrelated contracts. We
right.
just had a loan agreement.
Okay.
We didn't have a construction agreement.
So it's a common law or the statute or common law and statute.
Yes. That's correct. If I can read to you what the trial court said in her summary judgment order on this interrelated contracts issue, I think this really sums it up very nicely. She said, Mid Valley has no contract with anyone involved in the construction project. Unlike the subcontractors in the BRW case, Mid Valley did no work on building a home, had no contract with anyone, obligating it to build the home in accordance with anyone's specifications. That's a reference to the duty that was incorporated in the BRW cases and the subcontracts. Mid Valley had no involvement in constructing the home. It is an entity that exists solely to hold the property until it's sold. Under these circumstances, the court finds that the case is distinguishable from BRW, i.e. there are no interrelated contracts, and declines to apply the economic loss rule. I don't think that the analysis is really any more complicated than that on the interrelated contract doctrine. If I have a few more minutes, if I could also address a point that Mr. Riley made about kind of delaying the onset of this negligence duty until the house is injected, I guess, into the stream of commerce. That's not going to work. Number one, that argument was not raised below. I think it was first raised in the reply briefs up here. But putting that aside, the reason it's not going to work is you can sell the house down the line, and at some point, some percentage of houses are going to go into foreclosure. It's just inevitable. And when they go into foreclosure, they're going to be acquired temporarily by a commercial entity, just like the house here has been temporarily acquired. And the only reason we couldn't resell it is because of the damage. But they're going to be temporarily acquired by a commercial entity. And what happens then? According to Mr. Riley, that commercial entity is going to be able to bring a negligence claim because the house has been injected into the stream of commerce. Well, if a bank 5 years from now can bring a negligence claim because that's when the latent defect manifests, why can't my client bring a negligence claim? I mean, it took this latent, this defect about 3 years to manifest. The house was completed in 08, the defect manifested in 2011. It can take years for these kinds of conditions to manifest themselves because of the soil issues that we have, and you gotta wait for the right weather. So I just don't see that as a workable distinction. The other reason that I think his proposal doesn't work is that the duty arises at the time that the work is done. So the contract in which the defendants did their work was 2005. That's when they had their duty. So to go back years after the fact and kind of retroactively extinguish that duty based on arbitrary timing that nobody can predict, but then creates a situation where you have the duty coming and going, I don't think that that's workable. I think if you're gonna have a duty, it has to be predictable and it has to run in a fashion that people can count on. And that's actually one of the purposes of the economic loss rules, to provide some degree of predictability. A tort claim actually provides a fair degree of predictability, and the length of time that it runs is limited by the statute of limitations. It runs for 2 years with a 6-year statute of repose and a 2-year kicker if the defect doesn't manifest until the last 2 years. So, unless the court has any other questions, my time is about up. I would ask that the court affirm the denials of summary judgment by both lower courts and remand this case so that we can go to trial on it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Newman. Mr. Riley?
I'd like to address the Sadar argument. And if you read Sadar, I'm sure you all pick it up after this argument. It doesn't say negligence claim in it. It doesn't say independent duty. It says claims. As I've articulated before, claims being consistent with Town of Alma, the BRW, would be suing through the contracts. Got the right to do that, and they asserted that. Again, as I said before, they're doing the end around with the negligence claim. I'd also like to comment that Justice Corliss, in her dissent on the AC excavating case, talks a little bit about Sadara. And she writes in her dissent that basically Sadar was meant to limit claims in construction, not to expand them. They're advocating to you Sadar would be to expand it. I also think that if you look at Sadar and you would think that that would be creating some type of independent duty, then I think, as Justice Rice asked, I think Town of Alma gets overruled on that, and I think BRW gets overruled. The reason why that doesn't make any sense is because Sadar was in effect in 2001. BRW was in 2004. It was in existence when this court had the opportunity to determine whether or not there's some independent duties as a result of construction claims. And as you remember, BRW was an engineer in that case. Also comment about the reference to Judge Lynch's trial court opinion about the contract issue. Again, I think that was reframed by this court for these arguments about whether the after existing entity, I've already admitted that's a little bit harder issue because.
Let me follow up on that, because it is an interesting situation if the bank forecloses, sells to somebody else, and then has to take it back over. And so then if the bank then has to take back the house because of the foreclosure to an independent third person, where is the bank? Does the bank now have negligence claims, or does the bank have to go back to its original contract obligations?
I think once that sale has taken place, it's extinguished all the contracts.
And what's the actual legal jurisprudential sort of logic behind that? If we're looking to the source of the duty, and the source of the duty being the source of the obligations between the parties, those would arise from the contract originally.
Correct.
It'd be extinguished when you sold them, because there's obviously no privity of contract at that point.
Correct.
The bank would then take it back. What's happening then?
I have been advocating that once that sale takes place, those construction agreements have been extinguished because of the sale.
So the bank takes it back, and so then at that point you would say that it's standing in the shoes of the person to whom it sold the house.
Correct.
All right, and so why is that a different situation than here, where if we assume Mr. Newworth's argument that Mid Valley has no contract privity, that Alpine would simply stand in the shoes of Mid Valley, have the same lack of contract privity. I didn't ask that very well, did I?
I think I'm tracking with you.
If you could help me, please.
And the way I'm understanding your question, again, is that it's part of the interrelated contracts, and it's basically standing in the shoes of Alpine Bank in that point, because the construction loan agreement is still in place and all of the other documents that arise out of the construction of the home are still in place.
But once they're extinguished, once you sell it to an independent third-party buyer, somebody who has no privity at all to the contract. So your argument is that once again we go right back to this essential determination is what's the relationship between Alpine and Mid Valley? Now, some of the amicus have suggested that it's actually interesting on both sides that if we don't allow this kind of thing to happen, you know, it'll be difficult for one side or the other, and then some of the amicus suggest that it's really important that we not allow this kind of a safe harbor, the banks to extinguish or to create additional remedies for themselves in negligence by merely creating these subsidiary kinds of organizations to take over their contracts.
I think that
you've read the amicus briefs. What do you think of all of that?
I think that they want to make sure that they can still bring tort claims and don't have to rely on contract law. And as I've said today, I think we want to make contracts mean something. These aren't the type of entities that need protection by extending tort remedies to them.
So why doesn't Mid Valley having a deed as opposed to a deed of trust qualify as a buyer? Or a possessor?
It has a deed in lieu.
Has the deed.
Right.
To the property, owner of the property now.
And that goes back to even Sun Mountain being the owner of the property, still part of the unrelated contracts.
Yeah.
Because they're part of the construction process, part of the construction loan process at that point in time. They haven't escaped that commercial transaction.
Council, can I just jump in there? So what would you say in terms of what are Mid Valley's contract rights? They sued in negligence. They said they had no contract rights. Did they have contract rights to sue them?
They sued Sun Mountain, and they've got some type of resolution slash judgment against Sun Mountain. Sun Mountain sued HP, which you would expect, and Shannon Custom Homes got sued. Shannon Custom Homes sued my client, and that's who my client's contract was with. And that's how the interrelated contract should happen. And what I've explained to my clients as design professionals when they get sued.
But they got not a penny out of all this, right? This contract?
They didn't sue in contract. I mean, we never tested that theory because it was only suit brought in negligence.
You know, I think it was negligence. I just don't remember if Shannon Custom Homes' claim against my client was contract or not. I just don't remember.
Are there any more questions? Colleagues? All right, I guess this case will stand submitted.